Anyway, this is case number 54603 and case number 55514, Certified Fire Protection, Inc. v. Precision Construction. That is both the appeal and cross-appeal. And so at this time, we'll proceed with the opening argument. Mr. Soff, you're going to proceed on behalf of the appellant.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, my name is David Stopp. I'm an attorney with the law firm of McDonald Cronell Wilson and counsel for Appellant Certified Fire Protection, Inc. Mm-hmm. With me today is our client representative, Doug Sartain, and I also have another attorney from our office, Patrick Murch.
Okay, well, welcome. Thank you.
I would like to reserve 3 minutes. There are two appeals on file with this Court. Certified Fire's appeal relative to its claims against Precision, and Precision's appeal relative to the District Court's denial of its request for attorney's fees. Now, we're here today because the District Court erroneously granted a directed verdict in favor of Precision, precluding Certified Fire from recovering for work it performed at Precision's request on the DeLuca Liquor Warehouse Expansion Project, or DeLuca Project for short. Upon a de novo review, the District Court abused its discretion when it denied all claims for relief based on the determination that the design Certified Fire prepared at Precision's request could not ultimately be used after Certified Fire was removed from the project by Precision. The District Court was obligated to view the evidence in the light most favorable to Certified Fire. In that light, Certified Fire provided Precision with exactly what it wanted, what it needed at the time, and in an acceptable time frame. At that point, the designs had value for which Precision should have compensated Certified Fire. In the light most favorable to Certified Fire, Precision's decision to remove Certified Fire from the project and devastate the value of those designs does not preclude liability on the part of Precision to compensate Certified Fire for that work. Now, in the light most favorable to Certified Fire, these are the facts that were presented at trial. Certified Fire placed a bid for the design and installation of the fire suppression system on the DeLuca project. That bid was accepted by Precision. Weeks later, Precision delivers a subcontract agreement, and the parties begin negotiating the terms. One of the terms being negotiated is the requirement that the designs be provided within 14 days. While the parties are negotiating this term, in addition to other terms,
I want to pause before you continue. You've stated several times about construing this in the light most favorable to your client. And I'm not certain under 52C if a judgment on partial findings commands that level of deference.
Your Honor, we believe it does. And even if it doesn't, though, Your Honor, we think the facts are sufficient to establish, in whatever light you construe them, the facts are sufficient to establish a prima facie claim for the various claims that we're asserting in this case. The facts are that the Precision, ultimately 2 months after submitting a subcontract agreement where the parties were negotiating the terms, again requests Certified Fire for those designs. In fact, Certified Fire responds to a very direct written request on the intentions of proceeding with the job. Certified Fire sends a letter saying, "We intend to proceed with this job. We have an issue with this 14-day time frame with the designs, as well as some of the other terms of the subcontract that we're hopefully working through." After receiving that notification 3 days later, Precision again asks for the designs. Now, those designs are provided with another day or two, right? And those designs are accepted. They're exactly what Precision needs at that time. Those designs are accepted. They're forwarded on to the plumbing subcontractor by Precision. And that information is also shared with the structural engineer. I think it was a week later, Certified Fire is removed from the project by Precision. Now, at that point in time, under the circumstances of this case, Certified Fire has established the prima facie claim for quantum merit, unjust enrichment, and we believe a breach of contract claim. Now, Precision's only defense to all of these claims is that the designs contained a minor spacing error and that they otherwise couldn't be used after it determined that it made the decision, the business decision, to remove Certified Fire from the project.
It did not use the design plans, though, correct?
No, Your Honor, it can't. I mean, once you replace a subcontractor, the replacement subcontractor has to come with its own designs.
So viewed from the perspective of your opponent's client, there was no value conferred.
We would disagree with that, even, Your Honor. We think that from...
That was the finding of the district court, though.
Well, we believe what the district court found in kind of ambiguous terms was just simply that because the designs couldn't be used, right, that all implied contract theories failed, and as well as the breach of contract theory failed. But we believe under the circumstances of this case...
your best claim is your quantum merit claim, correct?
Without conceding, certainly, whether or not we can prevail on any of our other claims, if we're viewing the value of these designs from the perspective of Certified Fire under the quantum merit analysis, I do believe we have the best argument relative to those designs having value.
So tell me why the district court erred in rejecting your quantum merit claim.
I believe the district court... What we're really talking about is the difference between unjust enrichment and quantum merit. And under those two different theories, there are different perspectives from which you should... They're distinct theories of recovery. And under those two theories, there's different perspectives from which the damages should be valued and the damages should be measured. Under the quantum merit theory, the value of designs are measured from the perspective of the provider of the service or the product. In this case, that's Certified Fire. Unjust enrichment theory, it's from the perspective of the benefit conferred on the individual and having to compensate the other for the benefit conferred and retained. Now, we believe under the circumstances of this case, where we have a subcontract agreement that's delivered in early December, you go 2 months with the parties negotiating the terms of the subcontract agreement. On January 25th, Precision asks for the design. Now, they had 2 months of an opportunity to remove Certified Fire from the project. Instead of doing so, at the end of January, they request the designs. Then they request, instead of removing Certified Fire from the project, they request a confirmation of intentions to proceed with the job. Certified Fire responds immediately. We intend to proceed with this job. We're working through some issues on the subcontract, though. 3 days later, again, Precision, knowing all of this, on January 30th, 2006, Precision again asked for the designs. They're provided, they're finished the next day, and they're provided in the next couple of days. Again, those designs are accepted, what they needed. They were provided to the plumbing subcontractor, and also that information is shared with the structural engineer. Under those facts, Certified Fire both provided a benefit from Precision's perspective at that point in time, and also provided a value from its own perspective. The resources and energy that went into preparing those designs. So we submit to the court that under both perspectives, there is a value to these designs for which Certified Fire should be compensated. I think that value is most clear, certainly when you look at it from the perspective of Certified Fire. But again, without conceding...
No, I'm not asking for a concession. Sure. What I'm interested in is the basis for saying the district court erred as a matter of law, assuming I'm correct on the partial findings issue, in finding no implied promise to pay, which would be the hallmark of the quantum merit claim.
Right.
So that's what I was trying to direct your attention to.
What we believe is, we believe that is part of the reversible error, absolutely. What we think is also part of the reversible error was the finding in itself, the designs, because the designs couldn't be used ultimately, that under both theories, that there wasn't a chance for recovery. So we believe that there's reversible error on both counts, but kind of as you go down in the spectrum, right? The express finding was that the designs couldn't be used. I mean, that's clearly the basis for the district court's opinion, and that's, we believe, forms the reversible error. And then peeling the onion back just a little bit further, we think part of the reversible error was the district court's failure to distinguish between the different perspectives from which, you know, value and damages should have been measured in this case. And relative to damages, we have two choices on the quantum merit analysis. And we have to remember that this exchange in late January followed a payment application that Certified Fire submitted for the design-related work, specific to that work. And that was in the amount of $33,575. So that exchange, when they requested the designs, they knew exactly what Certified Fire expected to be paid at that point in time. Mm-hmm. Now, part of Precision's defense is based on the case Thompson v. Herman. The facts of this case are clearly distinguishable from those of Thompson v. Herman. And Thompson v. Herman is, the application of that case is very specific to expects. In this case, you know, Certified Fire provided exactly what Precision requested. The designs were based on plans and specifications provided by Precision, and they were, you know, specific to the DeLuca Liquor Warehouse expansion project. In fact, that's exactly what Precision needed. They forwarded them onto the public subcontractor and the information shared with the structural engineer. Here, Certified Fire wanted to be a part of the DeLuca project. It wasn't their decision to leave. Precision was their determination that they wanted to remove Certified Fire from the project. Now, the designs had a very minor spacing error, a spacing error that Certified Fire could have and would have corrected had it been given the opportunity. An opportunity, mind you, that uncontroverted testimony established is the norm in the industry. I believe uncontroverted testimony from Gary Woldridge indicated that multiple revisions to designs are quote-unquote frequent. Doug Sartain testified that it's usually four or five times the designs are submitted and revised before they're approved by the approving authority.
But that would be in cases where you had an express contract, not where you're working on an implied contract.
Well, certainly we're not here enforcing that subcontract agreement, but we believe that the standard in the industry as a practical matter, right, is that somebody has an opportunity to correct what would be a minor spacing error, minor calculation error in designs. And at this point, that's uncontroverted testimony from Doug Sartain and Gary Woldridge. If we wanted to know, I mean, while we're talking about it, if we wanted to know what Precision reasonably expected relative to CURE, we can look, I think, to the subcontract agreement, which in sections 5 and 13 provides that very idea of CURE. In fact, not just an opportunity, but a responsibility for Certified Fire to CURE. The value was ultimately stripped from the designs. If I may just finish this particular point.
Go ahead. Well, you have 3 minutes, so if you want, okay. I didn't know if you wanted to reserve.
I'll wrap up this last okay. sentence. The value was stripped only because Precision decided that it would remove Certified Fire from the project. I mean, that's what the district court found. Mm-hmm. But under the circumstances of this case, the designs had value from which Certified Fire should be compensated by Precision. Okay.
Thank you very much. Mr. Prince, for the respondent. Also, Mr. Prince, you can reserve time since you have a cross appeal if you wish to speak last on the attorney's fees issue.
I think I will reserve two minutes okay. for the attorney's fees issue.
Thank you.
If it pleases the court, Dennis Prince appearing on behalf of respondent Precision and cross appellate Precision Construction Incorporated. A subcontractor who does not either have a contract, express contract, nor have been received a benefit from any work performed by a subcontractor, cannot recover under either an equitable or legal theory. The simple analysis here is there's no contract between these parties. There was never a meeting of the minds. Certified Fire was fully heard on their issues, both pertaining to the breach of contract claim as well as their equitable claims for unjust enrichment and quantum merit. But if you really think about it, they're inconsistent theories of relief because you can't, on one hand, argue we have a contract for which you agreed to pay, and on the other
hand, the law lets them make that alternative argument.
Yeah, but they're making it in an inconsistent sort of a fashion because they would have you believe that there was an agreement by Precision to pay for design-related work. Let me tell you why that argument has to fail as a matter of law. They only could have completed that work. The design work could not be utilized by any other contractor. If the theory is that, well, the contract was you just provide us a design and that's all, that would be pointless for Precision Construction. It's not even commercially reasonable because another subcontractor, for example, Statewide, who was the replacement contractor, They couldn't use that design. They'd have, Precision would have to go out and pay for it twice. The idea of this was for Certified to live up to its obligation of the $480,000 bid it submitted on November 15, 2006, to complete both the design, the construction and installation, appropriate permitting processes, warranty-related obligations, and finish the job in an appropriate time frame. On November 18th, Precision sent out a notice of intent to award a contract to Certified. Certified never accepted that subcontract. There was never any agreement or meeting of the minds as to any aspect of this project. It became very clear almost 3 months into it, by February 6, 2006, he sends a letter to Precision saying, we're now in the process of reviewing the subcontract. What became unmistakably clear to Judge Villani throughout the trial, as we've indicated in our papers, that there, Mr. Sartain never agreed to the terms proposed by Precision Construction as it relates to the subcontract. The more subtle question is then, well, if there's no contract upon which to recover, what other theory could they recover? I don't think there's any meaningful distinction between quantum merit on the one hand and unjust enrichment on the other hand, as it relates to a manner of recovery. It may relate to how you may calculate damages and from what perspective, but not whether you get to recover. The cornerstone of the equitable claim for relief of either unjust enrichment on one hand and quantum merit on the other hand is the conference and acceptance of a benefit by the party you're seeking to recover from. If in Thompson, this court was very clear that the theory of quantum merit is based upon that someone such as Precision received a benefit, and it would be unjust for Precision to retain that benefit without having to pay for it. Similarly, unjust enrichment, as this court indicated in Lease Partners, that's a quasi-contract theory. In fact, they're both quasi-contract theories. They're both implied contract theories. That if the unjust enrichment is, you also retain a benefit for which you should have to pay for it. The concept is retention of a benefit and therefore conference of a benefit.
Well, how do you distinguish between, say, a volunteer versus somebody that expects to get paid, Mr. Prince, under your analysis?
That's why this case is so important, because you could have a commercial construction context, there's a natural flow to the bidding process, to the negotiation of the subcontract or other sub-subcontract, as the case may be. You can think of a scenario where a subcontractor was given a notice of intent to award, like Certified was in this case, and they never ultimately negotiate a subcontract. They want to live to the terms of the bid and kind of live in this gray world, and therefore they abuse the entire process. Meanwhile, the general contractor is subject to risk of delay. He's delaying the entire project for the owner, faces potential liability. Meanwhile, a subcontractor, like in this case Certified, held up almost the entire design process of the project because this particular type of sprinkler system impacted plumbing design, roof structure design, lighting design, and all these other aspects of construction as it relates to design, that they would never execute a subcontract. Go out and do work and later claim, oh, okay, well, even though we haven't satisfied your conditions, Precision, here, we're submitting to you a bill for $33,000. Meanwhile, Precision's got no work that they can utilize in any fashion. And as admitted, the two pages of drawings, which were not complete, were wrong on their face, could not be used for any purpose. Precision's being asked now to pay $33,000 for something that they didn't get any benefit of. So you can envision a scenario where a subcontractor would abuse that process, go out and start and do work, demand that they be paid, and never execute a subcontract as maybe the other subcontractors would. That's why this case is so critical, that you can't simply just allow a subcontractor, such as Certified in this case, to ignore their obligations, either negotiate up front quickly, because they received the contract on December the 5th, 2005, negotiate the terms, or tell Precision, we won't agree to your terms, so Precision can hire up front a new subcontractor. And what's interesting here is the design process didn't even start until after the billing went out. They billed for 100% of the design work as of January 31st. The design hadn't even been started yet. The design was not complete yet. They never agreed to that schedule of a value. They thought they were getting an entire design and installation, not just simply design, because it wouldn't benefit them just to simply have a design. So under that scenario, you have to look at what the benefit conferred is. That's the starting point under either theory. Because I think either theory is based upon a manner in which you would calculate the damage. Because it might be different from, for example, in this case, let's assume there was a benefit. How would you say Precision was benefited versus how Certified was damaged? And it's probably a better method to calculate damages as opposed to an alternative theory of relief. I think they really get to the same point. It's just a matter of how you would calculate the damage. Because there might be a difference of, say, for example, a material supplier delivered material to the project. Well, how much did that really increase the value of the project from a value, let's say you're building a house, how did it increase the overall value of the project? As opposed to, let's say the material supplier delivered $30,000 of material, it'd be a much easier calculation to find damage calculation without having to speculate that it was $30,000 was the reasonable value of the material supply. So, but the starting point of the analysis has to be with the benefit conference. And it's very clear there's no benefit conference in this particular case because the designs were incomplete, they were wrong on their face, and even if they were complete, they couldn't have been used by the replacement subcontractor.
But some law will allow a quantum merit claim to proceed notwithstanding the absence of benefit, compensable benefit to the defendant. In other words, it's quantum merit is analytically based on an implied contract where I undertake to do the work and we're going to work out the price later. And I don't see the district court made specific findings on that theory, but you're saying under Thompson it wasn't necessary because in Nevada, unjust enrichment and quantum merit are one and the same? Is that your argument?
Yes. I think as the way we've articulated that here, that's correct. I think there's a lot of confusion in the concept of one versus the other. And in this case, this court in Elise Partners talked about unjust enrichment in the form of being a quasi-contract. Whereas if you're talking about quantum merit, you're also dealing with some type of implied in law contract. I think they both are achieving the same goal. The only difference, I'm not sure if there's any meaningful distinction between either of them. But on the other hand, it's a way you'd matter in which you'd calculate damage. It's the main case, the Pophausen case, where that was cited by Certified that seems to have some distinction. But also, if you look into the case and the analysis, while the elements weren't quite the same as we've articulated them here in Nevada, there has to be what would be the reasonable expectation of being like someone like Precision as to what their obligation would be to pay. I mean, so there is some benefit analysis somewhat subsumed into even the main course analysis, because without a benefit,
point is that they were doing this work with the knowledge of your client, and from that knowledge grows the reasonable expectation of payment, not measured by the benefit conferred on you, but the expenditure of resources made by them.
Wasn't that really truly the risk of Certified? They knew that their design
delayed. That's the question.
Yes. That was at their risk, because they either should have negotiated meaningfully the subcontract in a timely fashion, which there's no indication they were ever going to meaningfully do that. If they wanted truly or had an issue with it, they should have done that early in December, not months later, all of a sudden we're at the beginning of February. And even as Mr. Sartain testified on February 6th when he sends the letter to Precision Construction, that I'm just now beginning the process of review, and by the way, here's our concerns with the terms of the subcontract. If you're doing work in that interim period, if you think about it, how a commercial construction project like this proceeds, they're doing the work at their own, peril. Either hurry up and negotiate your agreement before you do any work, because if you don't have the contract in place and you don't have a meeting of the minds, there is a risk you're not going to recover anything. So it behooves you to move forward more diligently than Certified did in this case. Meanwhile, you get the general contractor who is subletting, is responsible for the overall design and construction of the project. The whole project is almost at a standstill because one subcontractor, in this case Certified, because of the type of fire suppression system installed, was impacting all of the other designs as trades as it relates to the structural aspect of the construction. And so it really was Certified's risk of not having the contract in place or having some preliminary agreement as to, well, if we provide this design work, this is what it's going to cost you. We can negotiate the balance of the terms later, but you need to have this Precision, and we're willing to do the work for this amount, because the bid they gave was for a lump sum. It didn't have a little of values breaking down like a public works project may as to each aspect or of the scope of work. While they may have had an internal bid sheet that Certified used, which they did have, that certainly wasn't shared with Precision any time prior to them being removed from the project. I think Precision had the only reasonable alternative at that point was to remove the project after Mr. Quinn, the president of Precision, went and met with Mr. Sartain, the president of Certified, and they did not come to an agreement on February 16th as to the scope of work or price. What was Precision obligated to pay? In the context of a commercial construction project that proceeds in this manner, what were they going to pay for a design that they couldn't use unless Certified carried out the work? They're somewhat being held hostage by Certified by saying, well, if you want this Precision, if you want us to give you a warranty, you want indemnification, you want a certain type of pipe, you want a third party to come out and inspect the work of this type, we're not willing to do the work for $480,000. We want more money. Well, Precision, it's like almost holding a gun to their head. Well, how do we proceed now? Either I guess we can try to negotiate with you, meanwhile the project is at a standstill. The only reasonable thing for them to do is to replace and move forward to avoid any liability exposure to them. Meanwhile, Certified proceeded at their own risk. They should have proceeded more diligently with shop drawings. They should have met with Precision much sooner. They should have dealt with the terms of the contract much sooner than what they did. By saying by February 6th, and they picked up the contract December the 5th, they were just now beginning the review of the terms and conditions. That's simply too late in the game for them to have any reasonable expectation they should be paid for work, which ultimately proved to be valueless to Precision.
And the proposed contract had time is of the essence or strict timetables on their work schedule.
Did, that's correct, as would any commercial project of this type would have. This is a $30 million project.
Mr. Prince, could you briefly mention, you can also reserve time in this, on your claim for attorney's fees under the offer of judgment, NRS 108.237.
Sure. I think those are two alternative ways for us to recover attorney's fees. Judge Villani did not address at all the request for attorney's fees under 108.237. He examined the issue only under the offer judgment statute, 17.115, and the rule. We had an alternative basis for recovery of the attorney's fees under the mechanics lien statute.
But that mechanics lien statute is discretionary.
It is discretionary. So
how do we know he just didn't assume that as part of his decision?
Because the record is devoid of that. There's no reference in his minute order as to what his thought process was or analysis. The only thing he starts off with after review of the Beatty factors, which is applicable to the offer of judgment.
Right.
And with respect to the offer of judgment, I believe it was, number one, reasonable in terms of its timing, in the sense that I think every litigant has the right to assess what the potential risk is, find out what it's going to cost to litigate the case, and make a business decision as to what it should offer. There's no obligation to offer anywhere close to what the overall damage claim is, because we always felt that there was no damages associated with anything Precision did. It was very clear that Judge Villani, even with no defense presented, had no trouble dismissing as a matter of law all of the claims because there's an insufficiency of the evidence. Discovery was never going to bear out any issue in this case. While it may have for Precision, because we learned a little bit more about the internal workings of Certified and how it goes about its design process, how it uses its general manager as a separate company that actually does the design. Certified hires that company out to do the design. All of the facts and information are available to all the parties. It was really a document-intensive case. The communications were, and it followed a particular chronological pattern. So everybody, it's clear that there was never a meeting of the minds based upon the documents. The claims were not brought in good faith because there was insufficient evidence on any claim to reach any issue, even proceed with the defense of the case. And so the issue that Judge Villani seemed to have was just the timing and amount. I think it was a reasonable the time that we served the offer judgment, 2 weeks after the serving of the answer, that we took an internal assessment of what the risk was and what the cost would be to continue litigating the case. So, is there any additional questions? I know I've used all my time, but that's fine.
Thank you. Okay, counsel. Mm-hmm.
If I may just take a quick moment to kind of clarify, I think, what are some misconceptions. One of which is the application of the case. I think it's either asphalt or lease partners that I think might create some confusion regarding the difference between quantum merit and unjust enrichment. Precision ignores completely and entirely line of cases which indicates that quantum merit applies when you do work at somebody else's request or with their knowledge and acquiescence. That's another basis. Certainly there are circumstances in which unjust enrichment and quantum merit, you know, may come together and have a very similar result. I think that's a little bit of some of the confusion. In this case, what quantum merit provides under the case law that says you get to recover if you do work with the knowledge and acquiescence of another, if the elements aren't quite sufficient to form what we would consider an express agreement, applies directly to this case. Precision made the decision without a written subcontract agreement signed, a contract that we're not here trying to enforce. We're going to ask work be done. We're going to ask work be done even after we have some inkling, not just some inkling, we have a clear express indication how much Certified Fire expects to be paid for that work. We're going to ask them to perform work after Certified Fire expressly indicates that this time of an essence and this 14-day time frame for the designs is an issue for them. They expressly indicate that by letter on January 27th. Instead of at that point in time Precision releasing Certified Fire from the project, they press forward with the designs. That's exactly what a quantum merit claim is designed for. In fact, I think that under the circumstances of this case, at that point in time, when Certified Fire responds to that request with exactly what Precision requested, they confer a benefit on Precision, a benefit that Precision is required to compensate Certified Fire. Under either analysis, unjust enrichment or quantum merit, I believe it calls for recovery. Now, the point of the breach of contract claim is that there may have been communications, written communications exchanged between the parties that by themselves create the existence of a contract related to the design work only, separate and apart from that subcontract agreement. But whether or not it actually does, that's why the quantum merit and unjust enrichment claim were asserted. There's an alternative there. We certainly have a burden of proof relative to a breach of contract claim, and as the justice clearly pointed out, we have that right to plead in the alternative, and that's exactly what we did. They're not inconsistent. They just carry different burdens of proof. If we haven't met the express contract, we've met the implied.
Okay. I'm going to give you one more minute just to talk about the cross appeal and give Mr. Prince a minute to respond to what you say.
Absolutely. Precision sought attorney's fees under NRS 108-237 and offer of judgment law. The only authority relative to what responsibility the district court had relative to a review of the request is relative to offer of judgment law. And that authority is clear, that when you're denying attorney's fees under offer of judgment law, it only has to be clear in the record that the Beatty factors were considered. And based on that review, the request was denied. That's exactly what happened in this case. Very clear from the minute order, very clear from the order, that the judge determined the Beatty factors, and based on even one factor, which I think was more than the judge needed to do, was denying the attorney's fees request. Now, relative to 108, there's no requirement. I mean, it's clear. We're here today because the judge denied it, and the record's clear. The moving papers were very thorough. The judge had all the facts, all the relevant law, all the relevant authority, the language of NRS 108-237, and based on that review, denied the request for attorney's fees.
Thank you. Mr. Prince. Mm-hmm.
The reason why 108.237 is important here is because it does not have the same factors as Beatty. While it's certainly discretionary with the court, there's no indication that Judge Villani considered our request under 108.237. Beatty factors are very specific to the offer of judgment rules because of penalties imposed if you beat the offer of judgment. Under 108, he certainly has more of a discretionary factor that doesn't have the same rigidity that the Beatty factors might impose. And so, therefore, we're asking you remand the matter back, at least on a minimum, to consider the 108 request, because there's no indication in the record that he considered our request on that issue.
What factors would guide his discretion in the 108 context that would be different from the Beatty factors?
It would be similar to a Chapter 18 request for attorney's fees and costs, and what the amount of time spent, the reasonableness of the effort by the lawyers. I think that would be the same type of analysis that he would have to impose going through the Chapter 108.237.
And you didn't request attorney's fees under either Rule 11 or 18010?
No, I did not.
Okay, thank you. Thank you very much. Excellent arguments of both sides. Pleasure to have you both here arguing this case. And we will take this matter under submission. And we'll be in recess to our next case at 1:30 p.m. this afternoon.
Thank you.